The following podcast contains adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, everybody. Albie here from Thinking Outside the Long Box. I am with Greg Guler. You may know his work. He's been in a lot of things, Disney related. One of my favorite things you do did was Mickey Mouse Clubhouse.
Mickey Mouse Clubhouse.
I have a six-year-old daughter.
So you know the hot dog song.
I do the hot dog song. I love the dance. I do everything. And I've seen every episode maybe 40 times.
Wow.
And because it kept the daughter happy.
Well, that's good. I remember when they we'd have meetings about all the stuff that they were going to put out on the market, and before they played the hot dog song, they said, "Now we've got a song that you'll be singing probably for the rest of your life." And they played the hot dog song, and sure enough, we all through the rest of the day were humming that song. It's a little small worldish in that way.
A little bit
gets in there,
gets stuck in your head.
Want to leave?
Yeah. Whenever it comes on, you have to do the dance.
You do.
And it's become almost like a meme online. You see parents and their kids doing the hot dog dance.
Yeah, it's nice to know that, you know, after we're long dead, people will still be hearing that song and thinking, yeah, my dad used to dance to this for me.
Now, what did you do on that show?
Well, it was an interesting challenge because up until that time, except for some advertising that wasn't successful, in my opinion, these characters were 2D characters, and everybody was familiar with Mickey and Donald and the whole gang. First of all, it was an honor to be able to work with them. But my job was to, since it was going to be a CG show, to convert them into CG characters. And initially, it seems like it's going to be very simple. But in animation, these characters are known as cheats because everything on them moves as they turn. And it's easy to do in drawing. In drawing, you can just make the muzzle of Mickey go down when he turns to the front. If you've ever noticed that when Mickey looks at you from the front, his muzzle is lower, because if it was where it is in a three-quarter view, it'd be right between his eyes.
Right.
So all the characters, like Donald, Goofy, Pluto, Minnie, every character almost in the Disney pantheon of classic cartoon characters are cheats that way. Also with Mickey's ears. Mickey's ears look the same if you see him from the side or the front.
I had a question about that. That always freaked me out when I was watching it, that his ears seemed to change positions on his skull when he turned.
And that was intentional, so that when Mickey turned his head, it's traditionally the way it's supposed to be.
So it still looked like the Mickey Mouse
right.
profile.
If you go to Disneyland and you see the
hidden Mickey's.
You see Mickey there.
Yeah.
Mickey doesn't look quite right when you see the Mickey character walking around the park. Because his ears are at three-quarter views, and that's the only way you can do it, of course, in a hard-head character. But with ours, we wanted it to be as much like the original Mickey that everybody's used to. We've got a lot of letters, phone calls, actually some death threats about changing Mickey into a CG character because some Disney fans don't want anything to ever change.
Right, and even if it is CG, they want it to look like it was traditional.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I'm very proud of that show because we succeeded, I think. The one character I don't think I perfected was Donald Duck because he's very difficult to draw in any case. But an artist friend of mine who has passed away since, Dana Landsberg, I think cracked Donald in that case. And they're using these models for all their current shows. They're going to be doing more episodic story-related stuff with those characters. They've got Mickey Racers that's out now. And, you know, it just keeps getting better as technology improves.
When that show was on, did you work on it the whole duration of it, or was your work done pretty much in the beginning?
I think I was only on the first season. And then, like I said, a different character, Dana, came in, because I moved on to Winnie the Pooh and Tigger and Me. They changed the name of these shows so many times, I can't really remember which one they ended up. I think it was Tigger and Me or something like that, where Winnie the Pooh and Tigger are superheroes, and they go in the tree and they come out. With their
I don't think I've seen that one.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. My big contribution to the Winnie the Pooh mythos was the idea of having the mask on Winnie the Pooh. He has a mask when he's in his superhero guise, but he never pulls it down. He never remembers to pull it down. And I thought that was perfectly Winnie the Pooh because,
yeah.
you know,
Now I have to watch it.
Yeah, it's a pretty good show.
What do you design? What program software do you design the puppets in for the animation?
I actually don't do anything in CG.
Okay.
When I'm working on a CG show, I'd still draw it traditionally. I am so old that I still have to draw on paper initially. I do a rough on paper, scan it in, put it on my Cintiq, and then I render it in the Cintiq. And with the Cintiq, I still just do an line outline. It's up to the people who are building the wireframe and the color and everything else to put the modeling and everything
on. So you're
on
like the designer, the character
designer.
So
yeah.
They really come from you.
Right.
And do you get like a close to final approval of the character after they've done their work?
With the Mickey characters, initially, they would send screenshots of the character in a T-pose, which is meaning that the arms are straight out. And I always wanted to eliminate the T-pose and with more of a upside-down Y pose, because it's very difficult to judge how long the arms are on a character. And the initial Mickeys we did, his hands were on the ground, because it's very hard. You know, when the arm comes down, you know, the difference between traditional animation, the 2D stuff, and CG animation is that the computer only knows what you put in it. There's no artist watching it and saying, okay, these arms need to shorten for this scene. You know, in traditional animation, Mickey needed to reach out and grab something. You could stretch his arm way out. But in traditional animation, you know, they just did that. But in CG animation, the technician or the animator has to really work on that to make that all work. And so the hand doesn't morph into something that it doesn't
and
look like.
There's a
hand.
Skeleton and limitations,
yeah,
and stuff.
A wireframe.
Another show you worked on that I absolutely love, one of my favorites, is a Clerks cartoon.
Yeah, and that was a weird experiment Disney did.
Disney was involved with that?
Yeah,
I
was
no
working
idea.
At Disney.
Because I was going to ask you the difference working with Disney and Kevin Smith, but I didn't know it was a Disney thing.
Well, the difference was Kevin Smith and those guys, they have a whole different aesthetic, and you know, I remember being in a elevator with an executive, and I said, how much of that is going to make it into the cartoon? And she said, not that much.
Not that much.
And you know, it was a Disney project. Worked on it for, I think, a matter of months. And because there aren't that many episodes. I think there's like 8 or something like that. But
yeah, I have the DVD set. It's worth the buy.
Yeah, it's the main designer on that show was Steven Silver, who's an excellent character designer, did Kim Possible, did the Kratts. Worked on a lot of stuff.
What was your role in that?
I was just a character designer, and I remember I had to redesign. I was doing turns on the main characters, which is a, you know, a 5-point turn on the main characters. So the animators, it was animated overseas, as most TV is. So they know what everything looks like from every angle. I remember I had to draw a thumb a number of times because the head of the show wasn't happy with this thumb I was drawing.
They had interesting hands, the characters.
Yeah, yeah, and it was kind of a Steve Silver creation. Mm-hmm. He had, you know,
that was
and,
his style.
Yeah, it was his style. And but I remember drawing that thumb a lot. So it was a tough gig for us.
People probably know your work most from Phineas and Ferb.
Phineas and Ferb.
And I heard there's a new Phineas and Ferb reboot or something?
There's a movie in the pipeline.
Oh, awesome. Are you involved in that at all?
I am not. I had moved on to a different project by then, sadly. And I was with Phineas and Ferb right at the beginning of the beginning.
The beginning. So you helped design all those characters?
Well, I was worked in development. Initially, they wanted to redesign the characters a little bit because people weren't comfortable with a Dorito-shaped head and all that stuff. But Dan Povemeyer and Swampy Marsh basically moved the characters back to where they were initially. It was my job to maybe make them more animatable and a little more appealing. But yeah, I didn't know at the time, but it was just me, Dan, and Swampy working on the show, Dan told me. And so, yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was probably the most fun show I've ever worked on. I mean, there are a number of shows that I'm proud of, like Gargoyles and
awesome show.
Yeah, it was a great show. And you know, many of the shows, you know, you brought up Mickey right off the bat, and that is a show I'm proud of just because, you know, you're working with the classic characters. You're making a contribution because forever now, they're probably going to be CG. I mean, they've got Mickey shorts that are 2D, but it's a different
Mickey.
Are
they 2D, but still done in computers, though, right?
Well, it's done in computers, but it's still animated. You know, there's still a person moving those characters and making those decisions.
What's it like when you go to conventions like this to see people dressed up as characters you helped design?
It is pretty cool. You know, a lot of the characters that I designed aren't easy costumes. Like the Phineas and Ferb character,
right.
They're tough.
That's a
tough costume.
Yeah, they are, but you see them out there.
My favorite was I saw a couple who had Phineas and Ferb, and in their stroller was Buford, the little guy with the skull on his chest. One of the coolest things I ever saw was a few years ago they had a Gargoyles convention. Well, it wasn't a Gargoyles convention, but they were celebrating the 25 years of Gargoyles.
Oh, cool. They had voice actors and stuff there.
Jonathan Frakes, Marina Sirtis.
That's why I watched it, because I'm a big Trekkie.
Yeah. And that happened, you know, that once we got Jonathan Frakes and Marina Sirtis in it, it was a natural progression, because then we had an in to the other guys. And
did you get to meet him at all?
I did get to meet them, and I got to tell Jonathan Frakes, I said, you should be directing the next Star Trek movie.
And he said
they got somebody else. Abrams was the guy who was directing it.
He's great, though. He's been doing great directing on Discovery.
Yeah.
And Orville.
Yep. And, I got to see the Disneyland costume for Goliath.
Wow.
Which was cool. I don't know how much he walked around Disneyland. I guess they were probably worried that he'd scare people, but there it was, a costume based on my original design. All these designs go through a bit of refinement as it goes on. And
it's a natural process of it, right?
My design had, I had like things on his arms. And originally when we first started talking about the show, it was almost a Alvin and the Chipmunks kind of thing. A guy goes to Europe, he buys these little statues, he takes them back, and at night they come to life and wreak hijinks. And about that same time, Batman the Animated Series came out.
Was that an influence on the animation?
Oh, yeah. Big influence also on the design. Also Beauty and the Beast came out. And they were struggling with this thing. It wasn't moving all that well through development, created by Greg Weisman, great writer and producer. Tad Stones, who was the creator of Darkwing Duck, and he's worked Rescue Rangers, and he worked on a lot of shows, suggested that they have one cool big gargoyle, like the Beast. And that changed the tenor of everything. And then animated series came out, Batman. And I designed characters. I was a comic book guy. I drew Hawk and Dove for a number of years for DC. And I designed them as traditional superheroes with, you know, I knew they probably couldn't animate this stuff, but that's not the point of development. Development is just to get the thing greenlit. And Michael Eisner greenlit it. And then one of the directors and producers, Frank Parr, came in and refined the characters, took some of my detailing out, which really improved the looks of the characters. They're great. Greg Weisman, there are a lot of things that happen in this development process that are interesting and cool. If you watch the show, you know that they fold their wings over their bodies kind of like capes. And my purist brain told me, they can't do that. Those bones wouldn't work like that. Well, it's animation. And the reason they did it was, when you're storyboarding a story with these characters, if they've got wings that are out there all the time, you can't see anything behind them. Sure. You can't see any other characters behind them.
They would take up most of the frame because it was 4x3, if I remember right.
And, very hard to storyboard and, you compose a shot. And so they did. I think Greg Weisman suggested that and was a brilliant idea.
Makes sense.
But my contribution was when they're gargoyles and they get angry, their eyes go white. And that was a suggestion I made, where I had a character, of course, I had comic books that I drew when I was a kid, and I had a character that did that. When he got mad, his eyes turned white, simply because it looked cool. Batman. And so that's one of the things I suggested in a meeting, and it stuck, and I'm kind of proud of those little things you see in a cartoon that happen. I think it's a great cartoon show.
It's still playing somewhere.
Yeah.
All the time.
And You know, I have a lot of young people come up to me and say they love that show. And I say, where do you see that? Well, it used to be on at 11 o'clock at night on the Disney Channel. And
now with the DVR, if it's on sometime somewhere, you can watch it anytime. So
yeah,
that's the great thing
yeah,
about it.
It was a great show.
What's the difference of working on a comic and then working on animation?
Well, comic book is a lot more time. You spend a lot more time on a comic book because as an artist, you're not just drawing the characters. You're telling a story. You're composing panels. There's so much more that goes into it. When I was drawing Hawk and Dove, I worked about 7 days a week. And I tip my hat to people, you know, that can do more than one page a day because I could only do one page a day. And, you know, sometimes I could get two if I was doing a big splash panel or a cover. Covers you generally take less time because there's not as panels and you don't have to break down anything. But then when I got to Disney, my book ended and I got a call like the last few weeks of working on the book from someone I'd known in a prior job that I'd had who was at Disney now and asked me if I wanted to come to Disney. And so I got to Disney. Of course, I was cool about it, you know. I screamed, oh, like a little girl.
I think anybody would.
Yeah, and went there. And they give handouts with a weekly schedule. And someone has broken down the script and picked out the stuff that you need to do. And at the time, I was working on Darkwing Duck. That was my first show. And I was a prop designer. And a prop is anything in a cartoon that moves that's not a character.
Or a background. So it's everything else pretty much.
If Darkwing comes in and picks a TV up and throws it through a window, I have to design the TV, turn it around so that you can see all the angles on it, and also design the window. Because if the window breaks, I have to break it down into charts and all that stuff. Anyway, so they gave me my list, and, you know, I worked on it, and on Wednesday I turned it in. I didn't realize it was a week. I had a week to do this. They go, Greg, you know, you have a week. Well, I was used to working on comics, where you worked till it's done, as fast as you can. And so that was cool. You know, I was more of a leisurely pace, and I had some time to actually get to know somebody at the studio, and yeah, it was a great time.
Dream come true for a lot of animators, artists.
It is. And, you know, the Disney Afternoon was a great thing because we had a number of shows. We had four shows that aired every day.
That was a great time.
Yeah. And you know, as shows went off, new shows came in, so everybody kind of had job security. It was a kind of a big family. That has broken up a little bit now because, you know, just people come and go and they brought in new people from other studios. They had different ways of doing things. So it's more of a mix now. But now, of course, there's so much more product. You know, you've got streaming and you've got Cartoon Network and Nickelodeon and all these places that need a lot of product. And now with streaming and the internet, you've got so much more to do. And also, if you're interested in learning how to do this stuff, you can go on YouTube and there's tutorials about everything.
You can learn anything. It's
right.
Like going to college.
It's not like when I started where, as a prop designer, I had to have a huge library of books of props and stuff and all kinds. You know, there was no, you couldn't go on Google and look it up in 2 minutes. So, yeah, it's a different world, but, you know, it's a great opportunity for a lot of good artists.
I have to ask you, one of my daughter's other favorite things, her name's Serenity, she loves Lilo and Stitch.
Yeah.
Can you
yeah.
tell me what you did and how you got involved with Lilo and Stitch?
Well, that was another challenge because Chris Sanders, the original designer of those characters, excellent artist. And they hired me and Jose Zilea, another artist, to design the experiments because Stitch is
626. Yeah.
So there's 600 and, you know.
Did you have to have one for all of them or did you fill them in as you went along?
We went along. Yeah, okay. I don't think we ever got the
There should be a book
number.
With
yeah,
all of
well,
them.
Well, you know, let's bring the show back.
Yeah, what did they end it with 627 or I forget?
I don't think we ever got that high.
Okay.
But it was a lot of fun because, you know, in a case like that, you have to one of the things that I think I've always been able to do is to adapt my style to another artist's style. And there are a lot of people that can draw their style, but they can't emulate another style. So I, of course, have emulated the Chris Sanders style with Lilo and Stitch. It took me a while. It takes a little while to figure out how he draws stuff and how try to make the characters look like they're all from the same universe. But I think we got it. And then you go on to something like Phineas and Ferb, Tarzan, Buzz Lightyear, A Star Command, you know, Mickey and Winnie the Pooh and Milo Murphy's Law and Phineas and
so
Ferb.
So many
of
cool
course.
Things.
You have to be able to adjust to those styles. And in some cases, I developed the style, so that's much easier. And Buzz Lightyear, I developed that style. Lilo and Stitch, or when I first started on Phineas and Ferb, I called it Lilo and Stitch for the first 3 weeks. But Phineas and Ferb was pretty much a style that I kind of finessed. So, you know, that's a strength to be able to do that kind of stuff.
I heard kind of a rumor that you're working on something. I don't know if you're allowed to talk about it. Can you give us maybe a hint?
I'm working on a show by Lauren Bouchard, a new show.
From Bob's Burgers.
Bob's Burgers.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a great show. We're having a lot of fun with it, and I think people will really love it.
Cool. So. My final question for you today is, what is your happy place?
My happy place? Well, you know, my family, of course, is, you know, the most primary thing. But my happy place is really being able to work with people. You know, one of the things you learn at Disney, and of course, when I got the offer to work at Disney, I was intimidated. You know, it's just like every step you make that leads you up the ladder, it's got to be scary, because if it isn't, you're not making the right choice, probably. But, you know, working for DC was scary. Working for Disney was scary. But the guy that hired me said that, you know, you don't learn anything by people who know less than you. You learn to swim fast by swimming with the fast fish. And that's exactly what happened. When I got to Disney, there are people there so more immensely talented than me. And you learn from them. Being in that atmosphere makes you better. And it ups your game. And I really enjoy working with a nice team of people where we're watching each other's backs, where we're helping each other. And, you know, I have to say that in my career, mostly that's what's happened. You know, the artists and the writers get all the attention, but it's the production people. You know, it's the people that keep track of all, you know, artists aren't good at usually keeping track of stuff. But, you know, they keep track of everything. They keep us on schedule. They keep us, you know, motivated and compliments and that kind of stuff is what a team of artists need. If it's somebody just, you know, telling you to crank stuff out all the time, that's no fun. It's very difficult to be creative on a schedule. And that's a hard part of being an artist professionally. If you're just sitting in your basement drawing stuff for your own edification, it's great. That's fine. Do that. But have to do it regularly, on a schedule, and meet that schedule, and also elevate what you're doing a little bit, plussing those characters a little bit. And it's great to hear when a writer or, you know, Dan Povemeyer, Swampy Marsh, and those guys on Phineas and Ferb would say, you really did a great job on that character. You made it more than I did. And, you know, that's what it's all about. You try to bring as much as you can to the show and on schedule, because the people down the line, the colorists, the other people who have their jobs to do, aren't exactly happy if you hold them up, because they want to go home and eat dinner.
Yeah, they can't do their work until you're finished with yours, right? Yeah,
that's right.
I think that's what you get paid for, doing it when you're not inspired and you're not motivated to do it.
Yeah, you get down there and look at the blank page and, oh, man, I'd rather be out digging a hole today, because that's much easier in that regard.
No matter what you do, even if you love it, eventually a job becomes a job.
Yeah, it is a job. And, you know, you hear a lot of people say, oh, it must be all fun. A lot of times it is fun. Most of the time it is fun. But there are days when, boy, I tell you, it's a hard sled.
Thank you so much for being on Thinking Outside the Long Box.
It was great to meet you. Great time. Nice to meet you.
Greg Guler.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast. Join us on Facebook and Twitter to get behind-the-scenes information for exclusive content and to be notified when new episodes are available. The thoughts and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of the Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast, Baron Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is made available by its creators, Juan, John, and Gabe. The podcast is edited and produced by Juan, and Albie is the co-executive producer. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is a Barren Space production.